Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Everybody having a good con so far?
Yay!
Good. All right, well, welcome to Diversifying Your Game. We're going to talk about, as in the title, make your game more diverse. And we're going to look at it from sort of three aspects, which are playing games and doing game stories by diverse authors, having a diverse table, and having a diverse cast of characters in your game. So, can we start by introducing ourselves?
Sure. Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm the Adventure Path, one of the Adventure Path developers at Paizo Publishing. And I've been with the company 9 years as of this PaizoCon.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
I'm Jessica Price. I'm the project manager. I have been with the company 5 years as of this PaizoCon.
I'm Diego Valdez. I do customer service for Paizo, and I will have been there for about 2.5 years now.
He's the baby in
the
group.
Yeah.
So, which one shall we start with? Talk about having diverse characters in games first.
I don't even know.
Okay. Let's talk about setting first. Do we need to go over why having a diverse setting is important? I mean, I feel like we do this panel every year, and I feel like we see a lot of familiar faces at PaizoCon, so we don't want to just repeat stuff you've heard other years. But we want to know why. If you don't want us to start with the assumption that this is important, if you want us to explain why, let us know now or forever hold your peace. This is going to be a panel where we talk, where we try and talk to you a lot, because I just did the panel with Amber Scott, which was basically me asking her questions for a long time, so I kind of want this one to be more interactive. Okay, good. We're going to start with the assumption that this is a good thing, that having a diverse cast of characters is a positive, and that, you know, it is something that you and your players are interested in putting effort into. So, very simply, don't have everybody in your game be a white dude. More simply, don't necessarily trust your perceptions about what's balanced. They did a study not that long ago where they discovered that only 17% of the people in crowd scenes in movies and TV are women. Everybody else is a dude. And audiences, when surveyed, thought that there were an equal number of men and women on screen, when it was nowhere near equal. They have not done that for race yet, but I suspect that if they do, the stats will be even worse. So don't trust your perception. Like, actually count. I know it sounds weird, but it's something we do at Paizo. It's part of the editorial checks. The editors go through and are like, all right, NPCs, what's the balance? And, you know, thousands of thought there.
Yeah, we have a stage during the edit where the editors count how many male characters we have, how many female characters we have, and how many additional characters we have. And even when you're someone like me who is trying to make sure we drop in plenty of female characters and think you've had plenty of, or more than enough, the editors will still come and be like, we only have 6 women in this whole adventure of like 70 characters.
Yeah, so it's not that you're a bad person, it's not that you're a sexist person, it's not any of that. It's that we all grow up in a culture that normalizes us seeing the default human as a white male, and so we don't even notice when other people are absent, in short. And don't be afraid, especially if you have people in your group who come from backgrounds that aren't the stereotypical gamer background. Don't be afraid to go to them and ask them for, you know, like, hey, are there things in the setting that you want to change? Like, what do you want to see reflected in the setting? And I know that, like, you and your group did something really interesting with Grisia. Do you want to talk about that?
So, my group back home, I'm from New Mexico, so we have a very large Spanish Catholic population. My group kind of just adopted the Grisians as us. So, for our group, they're a bunch of nomadic New Mexicans, and that includes, mainly we did it by, we start with small stuff, so they talk the way we do. They talk the way we hear the people around us talk and that sort of stuff. And as we get more and more into it, we've built them into the larger cultural things. Like they're basically Catholic. They worship Desna, but they also take the Imperial Lords and kind of ask them to intercede on their behalf. So to them, the Imperial Lords are basically saints. So over all of this time, we've just kind of taken that, and it's worked out really well for our group because we just go and we're playing ourselves in this fantasy world. So that's been really great.
Super cool. Interesting. I love Perseid, but it's one of the areas of the setting that we fleshed out the earliest. So like at this point, if you work at Paizo, it's like, oh, Perseid again. What do you think is most important about? What do you think is the most important tip for making sure your setting isn't just forever?
I think one of the most important tips is find one or two blogs written by an author or a game designer or even a Twitch channel by someone who is a different race or a different religion or just a radically different worldview than you, and work that into your daily routine. Read blog posts or watch their trips or Twitch stream for an hour a day, or just absorb this culture that is something you've been largely isolated from for up till this point in your life.
I think it's really important to try and, this segues really neatly into our next point, but I think it's really important to try and read stuff that is actually written by people from, you know, whatever culture you're trying to find more about, because we tend to, especially the stuff that gets published, the stuff that gets the most attention, is a lot of times white Americans writing about other people's cultures that, you know, they find interesting, but didn't necessarily grow up with, and are not necessarily speaking from inside that culture. And so it's important to, and I mean, like, this happens in academia too. It's like sociology, anthropology are a lot of times not seen as trustworthy unless they're like mediated through a white academic. But you lose something really important then, because it's somebody from outside the culture starting from their own worldview and trying to understand someone else's culture through that worldview. It will teach you things you won't otherwise get to go directly to the source. And I think that it's also really important for our industries in particular, because we're kind of behind the curve, right? Like, we've had most of the people creating our adventures and creating our worlds be straight white dudes longer than, like, literature. You know, I mean, there was more of a movement starting in the 70s there to make sure that, you know, people were reading diverse authors. And so even, even for me, I know that I've had to unlearn some tropes that I learned that were very like, this is how fantasy is written. And it's like, well, that's how fantasy is written by British and American white dudes, right? Like, it doesn't have to be written like that. And in fact, the fact that my experience is different brings something new and something fresh. And, you know, I might structure things differently as a default. So I'm gonna go to the source whenever possible. And play adventures by diverse authors. Like, it used to be much harder than it is now, but we have an increasing number of female authors, we have an increasing number of trans and non-binary authors, we have an increasing number of non-white authors writing stuff. You know, it is something that we're trying to get better at Paizo. I feel like we've made progress on the female and not straight and not cis fronts, but, you know, we're still trying to get more people of color to write for us and stuff like that. But that stuff is out there. It's out there from mainstream publishers. If you're only reading, adventures written by one kind of person, like, you're at a banquet and you're only eating one dish. Like, it's, why would you?
Yeah, well, think about it this way. We all went through an anime phase where, for the first time ever, we found anime, and it was the most amazing thing ever because they had all these ideas we'd never thought about and all these traditions we'd never encountered before, and it was brand new and, like, exciting. And, you know, for Japanese people, anime is the same old tropes again and again and again, just like our Western stories are the same old tropes for us again and again. But there's that joy of new discovery. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that kind of media exists for a lot of cultures around the world. You can get that same rush again and again, And sorry, I just thought of that specifically because I've been reading Afrofuturism a lot lately, which is really exciting. And
it's so good, you guys.
Yeah. Sorry, I was getting distracted because I was looking up the author credit because I'm really bad about author credits.
Is it Izzy Shaw?
No, it's Charles Saunders.
Oh.
He's writing a series called Imaro, which is basically Conan the Barbarian as a black guy. So, yeah.
You looked like you had a thought.
Oh, yeah, I was going to build off of what you were saying. So there's kind of a habit when people do world-building stuff and they want to add other cultures to their to the world to kind of just go, this culture, this group of people is this because they do this thing. And that thing is just typically kind of like a big thing that pops into your mind when you hear about a specific real-world culture. But cultures are a lot more than that. And if you want people who belong to those groups to really feel that culture and really identify with it, a lot of the smaller everyday things are a lot more valuable in that. So if you want to do stuff like read about local, their folklores, read fiction by authors from those groups of people, you can often even find cultural studies that have just collections of essays from people that belong to that group, which will talk a lot about everyday. It'll help you be able to understand how they think, how they see the world, how it all looks to that group of people. And those can really help you really understand the small parts of life, which are kind of what makes the culture.
And I think if you're going to do something inspired by a culture that a culture or a demographic or, you know, a particular group of people in the real world that has been persecuted, don't define that culture in your fiction and don't define characters from that culture as only about how they're oppressed. Because, like, you know, it's like I'm a woman who worked in a male-dominated industry. I had to deal with a lot of sexism. I had to deal with sexual harassment. That is not the entirety of my life. You know, it's actually a very small portion of my life. And so, like, there's a tendency, I think, when you're coming from a place of privilege, and, like, we all have privilege in some sense, right? Like, privilege and marginalization spectrums are a bunch of intersecting spectrums, so, like, you can be a black trans lesbian and still have privilege in that you're neurotypical and able-bodied, right? So if you're talking to somebody who is dealing with, you know, somebody who's not neurotypical, somebody who's on the autism spectrum, like, when you're talking about that, you're speaking from a place of privilege in that regard. And, like, the ways in which you're not privileged don't go away then, but it's complicated.
It's just good to understand where your relative advantages are to other people.
Yeah.
Even if you're not overall in a great position
at
this point in your life.
And so, like, when you're looking at a way in which somebody is marginalized that you're not, there tends to be a tendency to just define them by that and treat that as if that's the whole of their experience, which, you know, even though we often come to that from a place of, like, trying to understand and trying to be empathetic and trying to, like, help, that can be really, like, sort of objectifying in a weird way, because, like, you know, nobody's just about that, so.
I just had a thought, like, no culture's a monolith. Like, if Europeans have a stereotype of Americans, but if you, like, had a culture that's the European Americans, every American would be offended because they're like, no, those are those people over there.
If you want to see what that looks like, watch British murder mystery shows trying to do American characters.
Yes. Right. We are all from Texas.
We are all from Texas.
I mean, at this point, just demographically speaking, like a quarter of us are from Texas. I am from the South, however.
My children are half Korean, so we moved from Kentucky to go to Arizona for my job. Different kinds of stereotypes, even amongst white people, just for the region of the country. He got the class, my youngest son, and he tells the class when he's asked to tell them about himself. Well, he says, well, I'm from Kentucky. There's just shock in the room, apparently, because they're like, but you don't sound like a hillbilly, and you're Asian. They just couldn't believe it. But on the other hand, he's now 18. I brought him up here. We were in the line getting. I had my swag. I was getting him a 1-day pass yesterday. He's in line with me, and he looks and he sees the mask of the white guy, and he holds it up. And he goes, finally, I can be a white guy.
And like the worst white dude too, right? Did you do your hand up?
Yeah, so from like a design development perspective, you know, would you say it's better, you know, if that's the right word or not, but I mean, no, when you're somewhere, like this room for example, even though there might be a majority of a certain type of people, there's never like, you're never in like Little Italy isn't still just all Italians,
right.
You know, things like that. It's just presented.
It's really never all been
right.
Italians.
Right. That's what I mean is, you know, should it be something of like, okay, so it's a crowd of many different people and do you spend time on a subset of those many different people?
So fiction sort of by its very nature can't actually be as complicated as real life, right? But that you do it in layers, right? Like first you define what is this country's sort of shtick? What's the elevator pitch for this fictional country that I'm making? If I need to describe it in two sentences, how do I describe it? But you don't stay there, right? And I think that, you know, there are many things about our setting that I think we would retcon today that, you know, we did 10 years ago that it's like, oh, okay. But the good thing about Galarian is we publish literally thousands and thousands of words on our setting every month. So at this point, we've been able to have a ton of detail. So we can go to country, we can go take a country that in the beginning was kind of a stereotype and was like, you know, this country sure is the, you know, sure is the island that is miniature India, right? And we can keep coming back to it and nuancing it. And when you are writing for a game that sort of has a sustained universe, right, where it's not just a one-off. You know, you may need to define stuff in a fairly shallow manner if you only have, you know, if you're doing a 16-page gazetteer of your entire world, but then go back and give it depth and be like, yeah, this is not monolithic. I mean, I did it with Kadira. I was like, Kalashite is not a single ethnicity. That's what people in Avistan think of, just like people in America tend to be like, Asians! And, you know, if you live in Asia, there's a really big difference between being Japanese and being Malaysian. And so, you know, keep coming back to it and adding more nuance and adding, making it less monolithic. I don't know, I talked about
it. I mean, when you have, if you're building like a product or something, you're going to have like your art and you're going to have your text. You're going to talk about the cultural in general, and that could mean that there's not everybody there is the same ethnicity or anything like that. When you do your art, you're going to show various people in there, and you can pepper it out so that you have people reflecting multiple ethnicities, and that's how you can demonstrate that, just like in the real world, not 100% of the people are here belong to this ethnic group.
I feel like we bring this up every single year when we do a diversity panel, but there is a blog called Medieval People of Color that goes through classical art dating all the way back to ancient Greece, where you can see that, I mean, Europe has always had black people, they've always had Asian people, just traveling in and out or settling in Europe.
And those people have not always been travelers or slaves or exotic curiosities. Black people were governors, black people were generals.
Alexandre Dumas, the famous author, black guy.
Yeah.
And like the guy who wrote Three Musketeers.
Yeah. When I was in college, I was in the art history department, and they had these books that were basically a collection of, it was by year, and by country, and it was just basically plates of every painting that they could find from that country from that year. And what you realize looking through those, you start to realize how diverse medieval Europe was and Renaissance Europe. Because like, if you get an art history textbook that's trying to cover all of art history, and you know, world art history from, you know, the Lascaux cave paintings to today, those are heavily curated. Right? There's somebody who's choosing what they think is important. And not to put too fine a point on it, but the white dudes who are usually in charge of deciding what paintings are important tend to pick paintings of white dudes or naked white ladies. But like when you look at, like, this is everything we know that was painted in this year in this country, you're looking through it, and it's incredibly diverse. And not just who is being painted, but who is painting, right? So like you get a really different perspective. Like it was kind of mind-blowing for me. I'm like, oh, there were a lot of painters who were black. There were a lot of painters who were, you know, from India and had moved to Italy. And so.
So, I think this is because we've both, I think all three of us at some point have had to tackle a claim of, like, it's not realistic for you to have black people in Pathfinder. It's like, black people didn't travel to Europe until the modern day, or until they were slaves, or...
So, A, but dragons. That's what they were. Right, like, oh yeah, my mom was a dragon. But black people, that's pushed too far. So
sorry, I wrecked your voice in the woods.
What does this mean about black dragons?
Oh, don't be racist. Hi, Eric.
Pay no attention to me.
Oh no, we're all good. We're all good, sir.
Yeah, now we're all looking at you.
Eric, do you have something to add to the discussion?
I don't even know what it is.
Publisher Eric Mona, ladies and gentlemen.
I love doing that to him. But yeah, so like, honestly, okay, I'm not gonna say what I was initially gonna say because he's a child present, but
No, go ahead, he's gonna try.
Okay, yeah, fuck your historical accuracy. Like, stop.
Yeah, remember, Galarian is much older than Earth civilizations.
Yeah.
Like, 10,000 years.
They've had way more time to migrate. So, yeah. Do we want to talk about diverse tables?
Exactly. So along with it, with stuff that's not necessarily that you can see on the surface, so like the LGBTQ stuff and and autistic spectrum, I mean, how do you represent that without necessarily being, this is an autistic person, or?
We go into that a little bit more at the Queering Your World panel that's coming up after this, in, I want to see, Green 3, or Olympia.
It's
over there.
It might as well be in here because we're all.
I imagine it's a large cross section.
Yeah, a lot of it is. I mean, a lot of straight representation that you see in books is through who's dating who, who's expected to marry who, who's in a love triangle with who else, that sort of thing. And you can do the same thing with queer relationships. I mean, the prince might be bisexual and trying to decide between, like, the princess that his parents want him to marry. It is
he a really hot
is okay, or a really hot adventurer who just rolled into town. Or, in terms of autistic, it's easy to say, well, this character has some difficulty relating to, like, traditional ways of people interacting with them, or, like, the town merchant is super, just amazing at keeping everything in stock and organized, and even good at negotiating with people, but will not let you go without specific exact change and understanding exactly what you need, or you find ways to show the effects more than specific labels. I'm sorry, those were probably super stereotypical. I'm not an expert on autism. Well, I shouldn't have tried.
So
we appreciate the
So there's two steps here, right? Step one is representation, step two is normalization, right? So if you have characters who have traditionally not been represented, I feel like it's more important to make sure that people understand that, like, yes, this character is gay, or yes, this character is trans. Even to the point where it does look a little bit like putting, you know, kind of an arrow there. But step two is, once you have multiple characters, you know, from a particular demographic, none of those demographics are monoliths, right? And so the diversity within a particular group that you're trying to represent becomes important, but like, you gotta have one first, and you may as well let people know that that's what's going on, because, you know, when you haven't been represented for a long time, it's a big deal to see yourself in it, and like, even if it does feel a little bit like there's a flashing arrow, sometimes that feels good, right? It's like, yeah, you know, we're here, and yeah. But it's also, like Crystal was saying, like, show the effects of it, and it doesn't, once you've been doing it, it doesn't have to be particularly obvious. And then look at the way that, like, whatever is considered the default is represented, because a lot of times you can just do that. And, right, like, part of privilege is privilege being invisible, right? So, like, a lot of the pushback we get at Paizo with our LGBT characters is, like, well, we don't want sexuality in our game. And it's like, straight sexuality right. all over the place. Every time you say that a couple has kids, you have straight sexuality. Every time you say that they're a couple, you have straight sexuality.
Half elf, half dragon.
You have sexuality, right? Half elves, by their very existence. At some point, there sure was sexuality there.
Cis lesbian and a trans lesbian can have babies.
Thank you. See? Normal, normalizing assumptions about heterosexuality. But so, like, we have sexuality all over our game, even if we're only showing the baker woman married to the male mayor, mm-hmm. right? So do the same thing for characters who aren't the defaults, right? And just in how you're talking about problem solving, like, read books by people on the autism spectrum and look at how they explain things. And when you have a character giving information, have them explain it in that particular way. Have them find the same things important, stuff like that.
Do you have anything you wanted to add, Diego?
Well, we're talking on that one, you covered it.
Okay.
We
have a question.
I was going to say, make sure it's not their whole shtick. Like, yeah, you can point it out, but that doesn't need to be the defining feature of the character.
Yeah,
it's usually like an aspect of the novel.
Yeah, there's no one right way to portray it. And again, when you only have one character of any given group, you, like Jessica said, you kind of have to put an arrow at it sometimes, more so than you'd necessarily like to. But once you start showing more diversity in your diversity, basically, if you only have, I'll make this personal, if you only have one trans character in your whole setting, they represent the trans character. They are every trans character, and everything they do or are about is implied. This is what the game designer or the author thinks all trans people are about. If you have two trans characters, then you can start to give them personal quirks, personal failings, personal strengths.
And you're making a statement about all trans people.
Exactly. And it's a lot easier to move away from, well, this is our trans character, who is also a fighter. In that case, you can go, well, this is our fighter, and she's trans sometimes, and...
I used to get, when I was at Microsoft, I used to get a lot of male game designers being like, so I want to have a female character, but how do I, you know, keep her from being a stereotype or a token? And I'm like, have more than one!
Plus, when you get more than one, you can start using them for villains and not feel guilty.
Yeah.
My personal metric is three good representations before you can start using a group as a villain.
Yeah.
So.
And when you use a character from a group that has suffered a lot of stereotyping and vilification in the real world, maybe don't have them be a villain in that particular way.
Yeah, right. So it's like the reputation for gay men is that they are predatory and corrupt children. Maybe don't make a gay Pied Piper character.
Right. Yeah, so, or bloodthirsty Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't. Like, there are so many ways to be a villain. Like, just whatever people have been, you know, stereotypically accused of in the real world, don't do that for them in your setting. Do you want to talk about diverse gaming groups?
Yes.
Cool. So, you have diverse people at your table, hopefully. If you don't,
you don't have to get some.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Pokemon, gotta collect them all.
Please, God, don't try to collect us.
Yeah.
I've been collected. It's not as much fun. Those Pokeballs are not as roomy on the inside as they look.
They're not the TARDIS.
They're not bigger on the inside.
But I mean, you know, whenever you have somebody being like, well, you know, how do I know what women think about this particular game, or how do I know what gay people think about this particular game? It's like, play it with them. So try and reach out beyond, like, if your social circles only include people a lot like you, like, maybe try and find some ways to meet people who don't come from the same background that you do, or who aren't going to have the same sort of life experiences that you do. Like, it's just good for you as a person.
Yeah, this is another area where blogs or YouTube channels or Twitter feeds or things like that from people who share your interests but have different backgrounds
yep.
really Well, one helps you not put your fucking foot in your mouth like I used to all the damn time.
Me too.
And a cool thing about having a big diverse group of people to play with is that you guys can build the whole world together. So instead of saying, how do I make this group represent these people? Maybe there's somebody who's in that group in your at your table that you can just let own that group. And now you have the different groups of people all over your campaign setting that were created by a diverse group of people that can reflect all of them.
And so, obviously, if you are having a bunch of people from different backgrounds, different life experiences, different demographics at your gaming table, at some point you are going to put your foot in your mouth. We all do, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. The problem isn't putting your foot in your mouth. The problem is usually how you handle it afterwards, right? So, like, get over the idea that, you know, it's the end of the world if you screw up, because it's not. We all do it. Everybody at your table, right, even if they are marginalized in multiple ways, has at some point put their foot in their mouth about some other group. It's part of being human.
Yeah, you can be gay and still be accidentally racist.
Well, you can be a woman and still be misogynist. You can be gay and still be homophobic, right? Like, we all of us who grow up in the U.S. and are exposed to American pop culture and American norms, we all ingest those norms and they shape how we think, right? Like, as a woman, you have more incentive to unlearn misogynist assumptions, but that doesn't mean that you don't have them.
Oh yeah, I used to hate trans people. For those who don't know, I am a trans woman, so.
Yeah, and
I think my reputation publicly precedes me at this point.
Oops. but like, I, you know, when I was in my early 20s, I was the
secret.
I thought it was hair. Uh-huh.
Because every trans woman you know has
that's
bright pink hair.
Yeah, that was it. But yeah, like in my early 20s, I was the I'm not like other girls girl. It's like, I am cool, I like gaming. You know, so, right, like you gotta get over it, and it's okay. But like, the big thing is, if you do something and somebody tells you that what you said is, yeah, we'll get to you in just a moment, that what you said bothered them, like, the knee-jerk assumption, because none of us likes finding out that we've hurt somebody else, mm-hmm. is to try and minimize it, or to try and put it on them, or to be like, well, I didn't mean it. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I know at this point it's a cliche, but I like the foot-stepping analogy. It doesn't matter if you meant to step on someone else's foot. You still need to, A, get off their foot, and B, apologize for stepping on their foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are a culture that will apologize for brushing someone in the hall, but if we accidentally insult somebody, we feel somehow like it is somehow out of bounds and inappropriate for us to apologize for that.
Yeah, it's not. And it's like, I know that apologizing can be like admitting that you've screwed up can be really scary, but like, you know, we got to the point on Tumblr for a while where Wes and I were apologizing like on a daily basis for stuff that Pfizer had done one product or another. And like, after the first time you do it, it's like, oh, you know what, that was not actually that bad. And people are actually fairly forgiving if you're sincere, but don't like faux apologize. Don't be like, I'm sorry you were offended. You can't apologize for other people's feelings. You can't apologize for how they felt. You can only apologize for what you have done. And so like, make sure that your apology shows that you get what the problem was and that you're taking responsibility for it, not being like, oh, I'm sorry you're so sensitive, you know? Because that's kind of what I'm sorry you were offended means.
Mm-hmm. Also, apologize, they will either accept it or not and then let it go.
Yeah.
You don't need to keep pressing it and bringing it back up, or just apologize and leave it alone.
Yeah, make a mental note to not do that in the future, but I mean, we all screw up sometimes. It happens. I mean, even if your friend is pissed off now, I mean, hopefully it is something that will be in the past eventually.
Yeah, and I mean, the same is going, and the same goes for if you're jamming. Oh, sorry.
Oh, and I was going to say, on the other, from the other direction, I have been accidentally insulted at the game table, and yes, it pisses me off, and it is something that I always appreciate an apology for, and sometimes I have to step away for, you know, an hour or two because I have a bit of a temper. But it's something that fades.
Well, and it's also like, you don't necessarily, the person who's been, and like, I'm gonna quibble a little bit with your use of the word insulted, because I think that like, a lot of times we tend to dismiss it as insulted. Like, oh, I made a kind of stereotypical joke about, you know, about a particular group, and like, oh, now this person's insulted, and I feel like that kind of can trivialize it. Like, sometimes the damage is more than...
I appreciate that, but I think we're working through slightly different definitions okay. of... But I see where you're coming from.
I mean, because it can be like, if it's the 10th time it's happened today...
Well, then it's a problem.
Yeah. Right? Like, then it's like, no, now I'm not insulted, like, now, you know, it's this I'm exhausted, and I'm not having fun.
Now I'm contemptuous.
Or that, yeah. Like, so, you know, and you never know, you know, you never know what somebody's background is, and something that seems like a fairly minor joke to you can, like, sometimes to them be, you know, I mean, I know that a friend of mine who actually moved from Eastern Europe, and is Jewish, was playing Monopoly, and one of her players was like, why don't you be the banker, because you're Jewish? And she's like, my grandparents literally got killed in a pogrom because, you know, the town thought they were controlling the money. Which is like, you know, that's not just a joke, that's like legit trauma. So you never know, right? You just, different people have, and they're not always going to tell you about it either, so just don't try and judge the level of how insulted you think they should be. But also, so if you're jamming and you have an awkward situation, kind of along the same thing Crystal was saying, like, call it out, be like, hey, don't do that at my table, but then immediately move on, because what I've noticed is that if you give people time to have to, like, face up to it, a lot of times they double down, like, they're embarrassed, and so they, you know, that makes them kind of double down, that can make them, you know, then you get into an argument at the table about whether or not it was okay, so just don't allow there even to be time for that to happen. Just be like, hey, please don't make those sort of jokes at my table. Okay, roll initiative.
And then if you're the minority and an argument breaks out, you feel like you're the one who... Like, oh god, this is all because I'm here. Like, even if you know it's not your fault, you still feel like it's your fault. At least if you're like me and you.
Or, like, sometimes you don't want to talk about it, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
or even just have that attention on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so moving on, really useful. And then, like, if there is a problem and you want to address it after the game, that gives everybody kind of a time to, like, cool down about it, to sort of process it, to sort of think through it. So, like, if you need to address it, go right ahead, but don't do it in the moment.
Oh,
so we had a question.
Actually,
y'all ended up covering, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Thank you for your patience.
Yay, sorry.
We'll babble and wander a lot, but we'll get there eventually.
It's valuable what now I'm wondering.
Good. Yay.
Can I ask, how do you feel, or what do you think is the right approach if you're in a group at a table and there's, I don't know, some sexist remark or racist or whatever, and you're sort of the butt of the joke or something? Would you want, I sometimes feel, I'm not sure if I should step in if that's sort of, hang on, I'm going to do this, I'm rescuing you, or whether I, like, if I'm not the game master or whatever, so I'm not in a position of authority, but I might say, let's not have those jokes. Is that, what's your experience of that, I suppose? Like, okay. Yeah, go, you know, like if there was some racist remark and I stepped in and said, hey, chill out, that's not the problem. Is that?
Well, I can't speak for everyone, but for me personally, I can generally tell when somebody says to me whether they were making an awkward attempt to be funny, maybe they just didn't know better, or if they're being malicious. And depending on what I see from them, I will react in different ways. If it's somebody who's just trying to be funny but is just not good at it, I will generally just ignore it and move on. And at that point, I feel like it's kind of up to you whether it made you uncomfortable enough to say something or not. If it's something that's malicious, then yes, I do appreciate someone else, because I don't like being the center of that attention, and I don't like being the only person at the table that's saying, hey man, that wasn't cool. So.
Yeah, that's really great. It's really easy to just say, you know, that's not cool, and then move on. And that's usually the level of response I want as well, but yeah, a lot of times if somebody's being malicious, it's really nice to not feel like you're completely alone in responding. Because, I mean, a lot of the time you feel like, if I respond, it's going to be a thing, and I don't want this to be a thing. We're all here to have fun.
I find it really helpful, just because there's a tendency when a joke is made about you to, everybody expects you to be the one to respond, and, like, they can see your response as being, like, self-interested in a way that, like, you know, when a misogynist joke is made at the table and a man at the table is like, I'm not comfortable with that, like, nobody's questioning that he's, you know, somehow selfish or he's somehow trying to get special treatment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's also just really powerful in that, like, if somebody makes a misogynist joke, at some level, they don't respect women. And they're not going to hear me in the same way that they hear another man saying, like, I'm not okay with this, right? And I wish it didn't have to be that way. I wish they'd listen to us, but they don't always.
I just wanted to add that, like, if they're making a joke and they're just failing to make it funny, and there isn't a person of that demographic in the room, you're preventing them from hurting someone else. Like, hey man, that wasn't really that funny. They maybe won't make that joke again in front of someone who would get hurt. So you're doing your friend a favor.
To put it in really stark terms, they found out that most rapists think that other men support what they do and would do it if they could get away with it, and that actually that sense of being supported manifests most clearly through other men's lack of reaction to, you know,
rape jokes.
To rape jokes. Yeah, I mean, that's why they sue them.
That was a really creepy study. I am grateful you shared that with me, but I am also really not happy I've read that.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, that's in psychology, too. Like, you'll have a group of people, if, like, one person is hitting another person, the whole group's going to sit and watch. And it only takes one person to stand up to make the whole group stand up, but if that one person doesn't stand up, then what's happening in the center is going to continue happening.
Yeah.
That was part of the Milgram experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had two very different experiences, two different meetings at different companies, one in which I disagreed with a dude on a design decision, and he was like, well, someone's on the rag, and, like, nobody said anything. And then out in the hallway later, all of the men who had been in that meeting came to me and were like, that made me real uncomfortable. And I'm like, don't tell me. You needed to tell him. But, like, later, different company, different meeting, guy made a similar comment when, you know, he thought that I was too firm in telling him no on something. And one of the guys in the meeting was like, are you serious? And everybody else immediately jumped in and was like, you know, so that, I've seen it happen. It's really powerful when one person does it, so. What else?
I'm asking us for
questions.
Are there any other questions? I
suppose one of the things, too, if you're in an area where you're not getting a lot of diversity and viewpoint, playing Pathfinder Society and making a tour of different groups that play.
Yep.
I mean, even if you don't maybe diversify a lot in the way of ethnic or cultural demographic, you're going to get different people and you'll see different things there. I mean, in the end, the goal is to say, okay, hey, it's cool that we're all a little different and that makes us frickin' awesome because people are weird and different like that, and let's just enjoy this. But I suppose really the goal is to say, well, we're people here, you know, but we've got some steps between here and there for that to be the overall view. But yeah, I mean, heck, even if you're visiting friends or family somewhere else in the country, could you extend your stay by a day or try to find that local game shop that has a different PFS group than you'd normally play with?
Online play.
Mm.
It's also helpful to just, there are very few people that don't have a lot of diversity that they encounter every day in their lives. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes through their whole life and sees nothing but white people and interacts with nothing but white people every day. So you do have friends, and you do have friends and stuff that belong to other groups as you do. And it doesn't hurt anything to ask them if they would like to play, even if they've never suggested they're interested in it. A thing that I encountered a lot when I was younger is that in the Spanish community that I grew up in, things like Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons were often viewed as a thing white people do. So somebody like me that wanted to do these things, it often felt, for my peers, it was often a thing about, I was trying to be white. or and stuff like that. So there's people who might be interested in doing these things that just don't because they don't feel like they belong to it yet. And just saying, hey, you know, we play this game, it's a lot of fun, do you want to come join us? Maybe there are people who do want to join you and we'll jump in.
Yeah, there's never harm in asking.
Yeah.
And there are, another thing with my sons that they had, they grew up in a biracial household, but they never really got to experience too much discrimination. So usually around us, even with just me around, people who might otherwise discriminate against him won't because he's got a white dad. So they don't. But when he was off on his own on a trip with another family that we trusted at the time, he was really racially discriminated against during that whole trip. It was one of the worst experiences of his life. He got back, and obviously they're not friends anymore, and we weren't wanting to do with them. But he's up until that point, he didn't even know what it was like to be a minority. And then all of a sudden, he's exposed to that at like 10 years old. And it just an awful time in his life for that to happen. And ever since then, his perceptions have been colored by that experience. So he's very, very aware of white privilege and where he goes.
And I think it's something that when, you know, hopefully we get to the point where we don't need it, and you have to be careful not to speak for your friends who are less privileged than you, but like being that sort of shield is a way that you can use your privilege for good, in that, like, you know, it's like, yeah, I will go with you to a PFS game. And like, anybody starts giving, you know, your female friend, your non-white friend, your trans friend, whatever crap, like, you can glare at them. And, you know, people do, it's one of our weird quirks, right? Like, if we, I mean, it's unfortunate, but since it's a reality, may as well try and use it to help, is like the same thing I was getting at. Men listen to other men more. White people listen to other white people more. So like, if you have that privilege and you have a friend who wants to get involved but is worried that, you know, they're gonna, if they go alone to a PFS game, they're gonna be the only person of color there and they're gonna get treated badly or whatever, you being like, I will go with you, you know, can help shield them from some of that.
Great power, comfort, responsibility.
No, but it's really true, though. I mean, I found, like, if you have kids or if you have friends that have kids, it really, really helps to normalize things for those kids. If you're running games for them, like my daughter, you know, she's Nigerian, and it's funny because when my wife and I, who are both white, go around, people would ask, is she adopted? That was the first question. Well, no, she's my wife's daughter, and I'm her dad. But she's got friends who are on the board, non-binary on the autistic spectrum, and I ran a game specifically for them, featuring characters like them, and it was really, really great to see, you know, how they saw that, you know, I'm not different. I mean, I'm different, but I'm not abnormal.
Yeah.
This is normal.
Yeah, I'm different, but I'm not alone in my difference.
Yeah, and I mean, it does help too, because when you watch the kids interact, like at their school and things, you know, I could see a marked difference between how they were able to voice how they wanted to be accepted after starting to see that, you know, this is okay, it's nothing different, it's just you.
Oh yeah, and that's a great perspective and a great way to shift. I mean, I found a lot of pride when I started thinking, I'm not weird, I'm rare.
Yeah, right? Well, and I think that's, I mean, what we do in RPGs, right, it's collaborative storytelling. Stories run on two engines, empathy and curiosity, right? Like, curiosity is basically what drives a plot, right? You stick with the story because you want to find out what happens next. And empathy is what drives your attachment to characters, right? If you're not attached to the characters, if you don't care what happens to them, you're not going to remain invested in the story. And so if we're only using stories to sit around the table and tell stories with people like us, if we're only telling stories about people like us, we're not even fully using stories for what they're good for, right? And like, the answer to prejudice, the answer to alienation and all of that, a big part of that is stories. It's learning to empathize with other people, is hearing their stories. So like, our games are such a powerful tool for counteracting so much of the ignorance and lack of empathy. If we're not doing that with them, we're kind of wasting that potential. So
we've got time for just the one more question in the back.
this is probably going to have kind of a big answer, so sorry. Villainy is a thing in these narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, evil is a, I was going to say scientifically, but is a magically quantifiable thing. There are spells that detect it, etc. So, like, it's that kind of moral certainty adds an odd dimension to this question. But a villain who is being portrayed as a villain and is, in fact, like, you can smell it on them, literally, with certain magic. Adopting the kind of horrific demographic-based prejudices, I feel like that narrative has become limited out of necessity. Whole lot of big words. As an example, I'm a white male, aged 18, 49. Everyone listens to me. And portraying a villain based on that notion,
Are you talking about fictional?
Yeah, I'm running the game, and I'm playing, and I am the villain of the piece is an emperor who rose to power based on riling the base fears of one section of their population. I don't know how to portray that without potentially terrifying someone at my table.
Honestly, I mean, there's a much more complicated and nuanced answer, but my short answer would be don't right now.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, it's
got it in the real world.
Yes, especially right now.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, maybe the emperor analogy is not as good, but
yeah.
Say,
ultimately,
I'm the alchemist who is sewing bits of people onto other bits of people to, I don't know, create a fourth gender with superpowers. Like,
I think we're actually out of time.
Yes, we are.
So.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you. Very close to that.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.